One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.
There's a whole fleet of them. Look on the ASA. Oh my gosh. They're all going against the wind.
It was basically a cube with inside a sphere where the points of the cube were touching the outside of the sphere.
So this isn't anything that just is limited to the United States. It's a worldwide phenomenon.
This is Michael Mazzola, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and this is episode 11, my interview with Buddy from Alien Protocols. Really, really interesting chat with Buddy. We go over an hour discussing remote viewing, growing up with psi gifts, precognitive dreams, an update on the Magi UFO. He remote viewed this, some really interesting comments about what went on, some Skinwalker Ranch involvement, and then some listener questions that you must stick around for. So folks, just a little summary before we get into the interview of this week. My next two guests coming up will be Calvin Parker. That was pushed back very slightly, and Calvin is one of the most famous UFO abductees on the planet. He has a really fascinating story that is just always incredible every time you hear it. So we'll be speaking to Calvin, and also Bryant Arnold. You may know him better as Dragon from The Curse or Secret of Skinwalker Ranch, depending on where you watch it. So Dragon is going to be on the show. I'll be speaking to him Sunday night. That interview will be released within the next 2 weeks as well. So a quick thank you to all the Patreons. We've got Doug, Jennifer and Cameron all signing up over at patreon.com/thatufopodcast. Thank you very much to anyone who does pledge to support the show. You, of course, get queue jumps, additional bonus content, and early access exclusives over there as well. And you can pick, if you sign up on the $10 tier, your own show to be reviewed, and you can come on as well. But folks, as always, thank you everyone for listening to the shows, and keep sending over your questions. Skinwalker Watch Along Episode 6 is available as an early access exclusive right now over in Patreon. That'll be dropping into the main feeds on Friday the 17th of July, of course. Two shows left on that one, myself and Dan, and we've got another couple of Skinwalker type shows planned to follow up after episode 8. A new show starting later on this week will be hashtag TUP Talks, totally ripping off the TTSA Talks, but we are going to be coming back to discuss, that's myself and Dan, our thoughts and opinions on episode 1 of season 2 of The Unidentified. And it's not a watch along this time, we're just going to quickly share our thoughts on the show, what happened, what we think, and then we're going to be discussing your thoughts, your opinions from Twitter, from Facebook. I've had a lot of DMs about the show, people want me to bring up different points that they have, different opinions, so that'll be really interesting as well. So look out for that later on this week, folks. Again, that'll be on early access on Patreon, and of course you'll get preferential questioning on Patreon as well, as a little thank you for supporting the show, but no doubt I'll manage to squeeze everyone's questions in and opinions anyway. So again, that's all coming up in the next week or so. Folks, just before we get into our interview with Buddy from Alien Protocols, I'd just like you to listen to a quick message from another friend of the show.
Have you ever looked up to the skies and seen something you can't explain? Or walked deep in the forest and sensed something watching you? Do you believe in an afterlife? Or a hidden veil that can communicate with the living? Then you need Shadows of Your Mind magazine. Download all issues completely free at shadowsmagazine.co.uk. Shadows of Your Mind, where your search for the answers begins.
Okay, folks, coming back from that message, we have our guest on this week's show. He is an experiencer, consciousness nut. That's a hard thing to say in a Scottish accent again. PSI practitioner. Is it PSI or PSI practitioner?
PSI.
PSI, I thought so. I just wanted to make sure I got that right. So PSI practitioner, ufologist, remote viewer, among many other things. We've got Buddy, the host of Alien Protocols on YouTube. Buddy, how are you this evening?
Good. Thanks for having me. I appreciate your time.
It's an absolute pleasure. This is a slight sidetrack from recent guests. I've had a lot of chat around the UFO subject and topic, and that's something we're definitely going to speak on. But I've said from the beginning, remote viewing was something I was really interested in, and it's been great to get in touch with yourself. And Jenna on Twitter was the person who kind of sent me in your direction. So again, that's it's really good to kind of get in touch with you. So
are connected, even. UFOs they and are. Remote viewing have a very intimate connection. And we'll get into that more as we discuss.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they do a very strong connection. So I want to start off, Buddy, just by discussing a little bit about your background. When you first got an inkling you had any particular gifts, and what kind of led you to kind of this point?
Well, when I was a kid, I knew I had, precognizant dreams. And I had the ability to see things in the future and influence things around me. And my mother was very, very intuitive. And she encouraged my intuition and, told me always to believe in my first gut instinct, my first intuition, which remote viewers called a gestalt. And that's the most accurate information you get is usually your gestalt. The very first thing that comes to you from a point of stillness. And it's just stunningly accurate stuff. So I've started, basically as a child, and I've always played with it and explored. And for me, it was more, I was doing what's considered now to be astral projection, which is, in my mind, flying to locations and seeing them and hovering above them or hovering over someone's shoulder. And so it's always kind of been there. And then I've trained myself in other abilities over time, because I think all these abilities are really kind of connected. And this is science. This isn't woo-woo. This isn't, imaginary. This isn't, fanciful, spiritual, something that's not tangible. I believe all this stuff, and so do the researchers, that this phenomena is reflective of a deeper science that we just don't know the science to yet. Oftentimes, a new science will present itself the very first time as a phenomena. And then as the phenomena is demystified, it becomes science. 200 years ago, a scientist named Volta took a whole bunch of paranormal and strange phenomena that was happening at the time and united them into the electromagnetic field. And brought a sense of reality and logic and physics to these strange, occurrences that were happening. And I believe, and so do many others, that this ability and the associated abilities around it, from the power of prayer to healings to psychokinesis, they all are reflective of some type of field. It's a field that has a tremendous amount of information and connects all space and time. So, I taught myself the different abilities over time and found myself just drawn into situations and working for a wide variety of really interesting companies, organizations, governmental stuff, and much more.
That's amazing. So you mentioned early on precognitive dreams. Can you tell us a little bit more what exactly you mean by that, and what my interpretation is that you're dreaming things that then come to fruition?
Correct. One of the earliest ones I remember is we had a swinging bench, and I had a precognition of my mother and my brother on the bench and the chain breaking and it falling. And I had told my mother about that, and she thought that was very interesting. And then within a day or two, that's exactly what happened.
So, that's pretty cool. And something else you mentioned along with that was astral projection. Would you say you astral project again within like a dream state, or is that something you practice through meditation and leave the body?
It's meditation through and leave the body, and it's nothing associated with sleep. It's during, you know, the daytime, you're completely cognizant of what's going on. And there's different types. Sometimes the quote unquote signal is very strong and it's very vivid and the experience is filled with synesthesia and smells and sounds, and you see images that flash in front of your eyes. You're almost compelled to close your eyes so you can see these images better. And other times it comes very sublime as information from nothingness. Once you clear your mind and still your mind and find this point of complete blankness, complete nothingness, the first things that come to your mind are, you know, a gestalt, and you write these down, and those are the psychic impressions.
Great. What age would you say it really started ramping up for you? If you're saying this happened from being a young child, was it your teenage years? And people talk about puberty and all those kind of hormones kicking about in your body is when these things can really come to the forefront. Is that when it happened for you? What sort of age?
I think a few different times. I think right around puberty, around that age, it started happening. And then it happened more in my late teens. And then after my mother's passing, I got a tremendous amount more then as well.
Okay. Now, that's any incidents growing up that you recall back to? And I'm not talking about, you know, what we might see in some kind of superhero movie or horror film where you're in some canteen and you make everything fly off the benches. But was there anything you remember that maybe happened that was particularly traumatizing, or it was maybe a more positive experience growing up?
I don't remember anything traumatizing. I've always had positive experiences around all of this stuff. I prefer not to let any negativity into my mind at all in any way. So I've never had any negative experiences in any of the esoteric stuff or, you know, the ufology type stuff. But I remember trying to move a painting in my room, in my bedroom as a kid, and trying to move it with my mind and trying to move it. And then I fell asleep. And when I woke up in the morning, it was tilted and turned. And I was like, that's really unusual. Did I sleepwalk or something? Or how did that happen? And then over time, I found that I had the ability to influence things a little bit. There were times where I was able to push a marble. And I didn't, it was not consistent. But when it happened, it was just like electric, you know. So it's never... You know, these abilities are like any of your other senses. They're not perfect. They're not flawless. You know, it's not like a superhero. But the more you work on them, the more consistent they become.
Yeah, I think some of the phrasing you've used, and later on we've got one of my listener questions, is latent abilities. So this is something you very much believe we've all got inside of us already. And it's just bringing it out and how you come about doing that. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly.
Was there anyone you looked to growing up? Because again, this is something that is quite different from most people's childhoods, that they realize they've got these gifts. I mean, I walked along the street and pretended I could move a crisp packet that was only blowing in the wind. And we've all kind of done those things as a kid and blinked and tried to make a light turn off. And that was one of your YouTube videos I saw recently. We've all tried it, but for the 99%, 99.9% even, it never works. But for you, this is something that you honed. So was there anyone you looked to growing up in those fields and in those areas? I'm thinking names like Ingo Swann, Uri Geller.
Exactly. You nailed it. You were psychic yourself. That's Ingo Swann is the top of my list. There's a lot of people that go all the way back to the Yoga Sutras, you know, 2000 years ago, like Nargarjuna, who said, if you still your mind like the surface of a lake, you can reflect the universe. And in the Yoga Sutras, they spoke a lot about these abilities. That on the path of virtue, these abilities present themselves, and these different monks would be able to communicate with another monk who's, you know, thousands of miles away, or, you know, heal an injured child. So, you know, in terms of influences, there's never been a lot. And there's also, you know, there's a great impediment to exploring this topic. There's a lot of, you know, BS with this topic. I've never wanted to be, you know, famous. I don't want to be on TV. I don't want to do TV shows or movies based on this stuff. I'd rather be like an Ingo Swann, someone who searched out researchers to try and get to the heart of what's going on here. And to try and, you know, leave information behind that others would find useful. And to help with the research, to nail down this field or whatever the exact physics is. So I really tried, especially in the past, you know, years, to make my abilities strong enough so that they're dependable when confronted with a challenge in front of a researcher or while under pressure. So that's always been a real important thing to me.
And is that something you've found that you can at will rise to the occasion when you have to, when you're faced with a researcher, or I was going to say a skeptic, but I suppose you have nothing to prove to a skeptic, but someone like a researcher who wants to look at the data, the science, really see what this is, and you know what's the practicalities of this kind of ability, and how can we make this more? How can we bring it to more people? What sort of occasions have you had to? Have you got any you would discuss?
Tons of them. I've worked with scientists that were skeptical or some that partially believed. And then when you see it yourself, you know, you can watch 1,000 videos and you can always assume of some sort of kind of trickery or, you know, video, you know, effects of some kind. But in person, when you see something over and over again, it's hard to dispute. Recently, I was at a lab in Huntsville, Alabama, which is the rocketry and capital of the United States, basically, and with a very big governmental organization behind it. And others were there, and they asked me to go through several different machines to see if I could affect different machines. And one of the videos is on my YouTube channel where I affect a shielded compass. And the first machine I was working on, but we didn't get a video of this one, was an electrostatic detector. And for the first like 10 minutes, I couldn't get, you know, sometimes it takes time and you have to have patience, and I couldn't get it to go. And someone said something to me, like one of the scientists was like taunting me, you know, like, you want to give up yet? And I was like, no way. I'm just starting to get the feel of the character of this funny machine. And within a couple of minutes, it started moving and kept moving and kept moving and kept moving beyond the point of, you know, any chance or, you know, any outside interference. You know, I've been challenged a lot and tested a lot, from bending metal screwdrivers in front of people and scientists and reporters and stuff without touching them. You can hold the handle, but wave your hand over the part that you want in the way you want it to bend, and it would bend. And, you know, this stuff, it's so extraordinary. It's so outside of most people's daily experiences that it's really logical and easy to negate its possibility. But the shocking and astonishing truth is that this stuff is real.
You mentioned growing up, so I nailed Ingo Swann from your point of view. I also mentioned Uri Geller. Now, Ingo Swann, you mentioned, was someone who sought out the researchers and really wanted to look at the scientific side of this. Would you say that an Uri Geller, who's maybe more famous here in the UK for being a bit of a celebrity, he's done a lot of TV shows over the years, do you have anything against someone like that? Who
I kind of do.
Yeah.
I kind of do. And recently he said he was going to remote influence Theresa May about Brexit. And, you know, I wrote him and said, you know, it's not going to happen. It's not going to work. You know, you can't do it. It won't work. You know, and if anything, I'll try and stop you, you know. And she ended up voting for it like 5 times or something, so he had failed consistently in that one. But he's always been a performer, and I believe he's been mixing magic tricks with this stuff. And you don't need to mix the magic tricks. You know, you have to be willing to fail, because sometimes you will fail. But if you watch enough, you will see things that are so miraculous, so statistically beyond the realm of probability, that you are left kind of gobsmacked.
Yeah, there's another incident famously a couple of years ago where Uri Geller claimed to have moved a football from a penalty spot or a soccer game, for those listening in the US, with his mind, to help the English national football team out. So yeah, I definitely think there's an element of showmanship and character there that's maybe more fitting of an Ancient Aliens than any other type of show. But yeah, no, so you've got those two different paths that an Ingo Swann and an Uri Geller kind of obviously went
and there's
careers.
Straight up scam artists too, you know, the neon light psychics, even though they may have real insights and they may have their natural ability like everyone have and produce real information, oftentimes they're associated with scams and money scams and all of that. So I make a big effort not to charge for any of the stuff that I do. People are welcome to give donations if they find our work helpful, but you know, we don't charge and I don't charge and I teach for free, and unless it's like a private class or something. So, you know, it's really important to me to try to maintain as much integrity in this mysterious field as possible.
Yeah, and I think the integrity definitely helps the credibility side of things, like you say. So again, what sort of practice and training goes into nourishing those abilities? So we know you've hit puberty in late teens and you're starting to do more and more, looking things like static, pushing a marble, those sorts of things. How do you harness those and get the most out of those abilities?
Well, some you just have to try for the first time. You just have to push it. Like the first time I tried to do a healing, it was a sick dog that we had, and I just tried and prayed, and you know those. And I consider myself a Christian, and so I pray and I consider all these gifts from God. I don't, you know, there's a lot of evangelicals who find this sort of thing evil or demonic or whatever, but I find that really ironic as someone who believes all of these are just, you know, the gifts that God has given us. So you know, you try something, and then you keep trying it. And you try to hone it and improve it. And over time, if you're tenacious enough, you'll see the results. And sometimes it's a lot faster than you think. You know, the first time I tried to bend metal, I was almost like giggling at myself, like, how silly is this? You know, what am I trying to do? And when it started to move and bend, you get this whole sensation over your body. It's almost like goosebumps, and you get warm. And it's almost because, you know, it's just so exciting and thrilling and unbelievable and amazing. And it just, you know, it's self-rewarding. Patience and tenacity are self-rewarding with the results that come from it. I've worked with a couple of big companies and big groups and well-known associations. And sometimes at the beginning, typically at the beginning, it's a feeling out process. So it's not like, boom, out of the gates, I'm, you know, kicking butt. Sometimes it is, but most of the time it's more a sense of trying to get a sense of the signal, the location, like a tuning fork trying to find the frequency of another tuning fork. Where if you don't have the right note, it's not going to quite sync, but the second you get the right frequency, they're both humming and vibrating, you know, across a distance.
Okay. So there's a lot there and everything being connected. And I know that's something that you've talked about a lot and a lot of other people have. And I think particularly the last couple of years, I've seen, if we want to talk a little bit about the UFO subject, more and more this idea that everything's connected. We're not looking at aliens from another planet hopping in a flying saucer and coming to say hello. There's more to it with this phenomena rather than just extraterrestrials necessarily as well, which for me is becoming more and more of the way I'm thinking about it. So I want to just,
and that's really the truth. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm going to get to some of that as well. And there's some of this that for me, it makes a lot more sense than we've got one group of aliens coming to visit us who are technologically advanced. And that's it. As you start to see some of the testimony from pilots, what they're seeing, some of the videos that are online that are, as camera phones get better and you're getting 4K and 8K videos of some of these shape-shifting entities in the sky, it's clear that that's not a physical saucer or that's not a ship, but then some of these things are. So it's definitely evolving the way I'm thinking about it as well.
You know, the obvious connection between the UFOs and these abilities and phenomena like the Skinwalker Ranch and haunted houses and things like that is consciousness. And like I was saying before about there being some sort of a field, if there is a field, some sort of substructure underneath this reality, kind of like the electromagnetic field was, that has a connection to every place, every time, then you would think an advanced civilization would understand that field and that technology very well and utilize it as well. It would almost mandate that advanced technology would.
I'm going to give a crass example here, so forgive me, but do you mean when you talk about a field, something like Star Wars, where you've got the Force, do you mean something like that that's behind everything, or is it something else?
It's like the electromagnetic field is something that's invisible. Humans have lived around it, you know, our entire existence, but we couldn't define it. We couldn't see it unless rare circumstances like lightning bolts or static electricity when you walk across a carpet or rub two fabrics together. It's a law and a structure that makes up our reality that's not visually tangible, but is observable, or is it presents itself under certain very specific conditions. So there's a belief in physics, a big debate about the role that consciousness plays in reality. The famous two-slit experiment and many others, where physicists are not sure why observation seems to literally affect space-time and matter. But it's definitively, scientifically true that the observation of subatomic particles affects their reality. And not just that you're seeing them, or that if you're using, you know, lights to bounce off of them to identify their location. It's much deeper than that. They've done all sorts of experiments, and it's proven that consciousness and reality are essentially interwoven like a tapestry. So it's not space, time, matter, and energy first, or consciousness first, as many different people in this field hypothesize. I believe it's a tapestry, that they're both interwoven very deeply. You can't have a consciousness without energy, space, time, and matter, and energy, space, time, and matter are completely meaningless if there's no consciousness to observe it. So it's like the classic, you know, if a bear poops in the woods, you know, or a tree falls in the woods,
yeah,
and no one's watching or no one sees the poop, did it happen? And physics has told us that something called a superposition, which is kind of unusual. And superposition means it did happen and it didn't happen simultaneously. And it's not determined until it's observed.
It's a bit of a Schrodinger's cat type thing, that the cat in the box. Is the cat dead? Is the cat there? Is the cat turned into a two-headed dragon? We don't know. It might have, but we can't see it. So,
yes, and it's in fact both. You know, it's kind of both. They're in this superposition until an observation causes reality to make a decision. So we're just beginning to understand consciousness and its role in the physical world.
How do you define consciousness yourself?
In the most basic definition, it's an awareness of your surroundings. And different creatures have different levels of consciousness. Some might say because an amoeba can react to its environment, that maybe it has consciousness. Yeah, I don't know about that, but obviously animals have consciousness down to the smallest sizes. It's something that I don't completely understand myself. I don't understand the complete parameters of it, but I'm an explorer of it. That's for certain.
I think what's for certain as well is we're all exploring it. We might not be aware we're exploring it, but we're all here. So for some reason, whether we chose it and we don't know it or not, that we're experiencing the same thing potentially. So I want to touch on remote viewing. So what would you say if someone asked you, you know, point blank, what exactly is remote viewing? How would you explain it?
I would explain it simply as it is a 7-page process that's very deliberative and very, it has very specific instructions for every point throughout the process. And it is a way to see distant places and things and times without being there. And it was basically invented in its modern form by Ingo Swann, working with SRI, Stanford Research Institute, and the CIA. And there was a very active program for 20 years with the CIA and remote viewers doing amazing, staggering feats. And Ingo was one of the best of all of them. There's a great documentary out now called Third Eye Spies, directed by Lance Mungia. And it really takes you through the facts and the evidence and the amazing stories. And in fact, I've been speaking with Lance for a while, and him and this head scientist from an organization had been testing me, and they tested me 3 times, surprised me out of nowhere. And, you know, I got a home run on all 3 of them, really staggering results.
I mean, if I was going to throw it out there, would the scientists be Hal Putov and would the organization be TTSA, or would you not be able to say that?
I'll say no to that, but the scientists, it's come out. The information has come out, and Skinwalker Ranch, I've worked with them for 2 years now, the head scientist, Eric Bard, there.
I will hold off on that because I have a whole section on that for you. So, yeah.
Great.
That's good to know, though. So when you talked about the project that had gone on with the CIA and Third Eye Spies, just for those who haven't seen it, like you say, is a great documentary, great piece of filmmaking, and it's now available on Amazon Prime, included with a Prime subscription, or you can rent it. I rented it when it first came out, so it's well worth the £2.49 or $4, whatever that might be over in the US. So definitely recommend watching that. But that would be Project Stargate, and you're looking at Russell Targ and Hal Putov, who is now obviously with TTSA as well. And they've done some incredible work with the likes of Ingo Swann and others, like you say, who maybe aren't as famous.
And they trained people out of nowhere, soldiers. They took a soldier named Joe McMonagle and trained him in it. And he became one of the very best. He was also a great graphic artist. So he was able to render beautiful, very specific drawings of stuff. That's just staggering. Some of the information, when you see the movie, you're like, it's you know, every time it happens with me, I'm staggered by it. It's wondrous. It's really, really incredible.
And would you say remote viewing, because this is something that I've just seen more recently as well, that it's not necessarily always seeing an exact picture in your head, that if you're given a target and the target's going to be the Eiffel Tower, you don't always necessarily see the Eiffel Tower and you can point that out, but you would describe it and it would be a feeling and it would be descriptions and what's round about it, and you would see, rather than, you know, it's a tower, it's a point and it's got legs, and is that how it works?
Yes, you know, and in fact, for some reason, and they say you're not supposed to try to name the target. You're supposed to try and give all the feelings around it, what it's composed of, and the environment. And as you go through the process more and more, these details come out. And with the full CRV, controlled remote viewing method, you can even use clay and stuff as one of the very advanced techniques. And when you're done, the images, you don't try and say what it is, you draw it, and sometimes it'll be apparent, oh, that's a volcano, or oh, that's the Eiffel Tower, or, you know, that's, you know, Notre Dame, or, you know, the Colosseum. And, you know, technically you're not supposed to name them, but as you get more advanced, that ability does present itself, where you can name targets and really nail targets. On my YouTube channel, you can see a bunch of different, you know, experiences that have happened recently where, you know, I specifically nailed the target, and it's always baffling and exciting and thrilling and wondrous.
Yeah, I watched some of yours, and also someone who I think you're working with just now is Omar.
Omar, he's great.
I love the text messages, and I think it's up on your Twitter feed as well, at Alien Protocols, for people to see. But the description sounds really confusing at first, but then when you see the actual picture that he manages to describe, it's perfect. The whole concept of feeling like there's kneeling involved. And
yes,
it's one of the, is that an Egyptian goddess?
Yes, it was Hathor. And in fact, the text, of course, was a lot longer. And I'd never met Omar before. I just, you know, through online and stuff like that. And he was just trying to challenge me and test if I was the real deal or not. So he only gave me a target number. The only information I had was 8 digits, 8 numbers, and those represent the target. They used to use longitude and latitude and things like that, but then people could memorize longitude and latitude and get a sense of where things were. So they advanced it to just strictly what's called a target number. And so with controlled remote viewing, you get just a target number, and the information just flows. And that one just flowed. It was strange details, like it's an ancient depiction of something older, and there was a white cow in it, and there was kneeling, and vines, I'm feeling like a little thin vines of ivy, and all those things were present in you know, you can watch the video and see, and it was a dead ringer. And a few weeks before that, the scientists from that location and Lance Mungia had called me out of nowhere with another target, and I had nailed that one too. It was electrical wiring. And in my drawings, the wirings were coming out of a roof, like a lighting fixture. So it was just the hole, and the wirings come out and bent at a 45-degree angle. And I had drawn them doing just that, bending at the 45-degree angle, and said that it was electrical wires.
Yeah, I always find that fascinating. And was it Ingo Swann? And if I'm wrong, I'll edit this out to make myself look better. But was it Ingo Swann that was famously asked to... I'm sure it was the US military, something like that, and to pinpoint a target, and they thought he'd gotten the target wrong, but what they'd actually pinpointed was US nuclear submarine positions out in the sea.
Yeah.
Am I getting that right?
Yeah, you're right. They've also had targets, and they, this is a famous story about Pat Price, who was one of the famous ones. He was a police detective who utilized his abilities to bust criminals. And he was one of the very few who could do level 7, phase 7 targets. And those are the most difficult, like a sentence or words, very highly detailed information. And so they had a target on a hill for them. And he said, wait, there's something else more interesting, just a couple miles, a mile and a half away up the hill here. And it ended up being a secret CIA listening post. He not only described the area, but he went inside one of the offices, opened up one of the files, and named different file programs, folders of them. And they were all, I think, related to billiards. And it was they nailed it. And it was so frightful that the CIA had to reassess the entire program to see what they were doing, if, you know, something fishy was going on, if it was, you know, some spy network or something. So the CIA even had, you know, controllers and assessors come in every year and try and, you know, see the value of this program. And what they learned to do, what Russell learned to do, was to teach the assessor how to do basic remote viewing, and they would do a target. And they did incredibly well, you know, for their very first time, and so that helped them continue the program for 20 years.
It's the sort of thing that would be rubbished in documentation and it's kind of played down. Do you think it's still something, though, that's widely used in the background in these sorts of organizations and still something they pursue?
Not widely used, but it is definitely used.
Okay. What are some of the things that you've remote viewed that you could talk about that, I don't want to use the word interesting because it's all particularly interesting, but from a UFO or alien point of view, have you ever tried to remote view something off Earth on a different planet?
The first thing, and I always, this was very important for me, is to increase my accuracy on verifiable targets first. So if you know your accuracy on a verifiable target, when you have a unverifiable target, at least you'll have a general idea how accurate you are. So after I'd really established that for myself, then I started venturing into more and more of the UFO stuff. But some of those just came up with targets. Grant Cameron's assistant had a target for me and was testing me. And I drew the drawing, and my gestalt was a spaceship in space with a big planet right next to it, another yellow, a yellow sun and a blue kind of sun, and the craft kind of going across it like this. And I kept saying, oh, this is so stupid. I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to fail. She's going to think I'm an idiot. And it was an exact replica of the picture that she had. So that was a really neat one. I've done a bunch of stuff in that area, from UFO bases to the Nimitz incident to underwater stuff to stuff on other planets to moons of Jupiter. I've done a lot of stuff. In fact, I was just on the phone with Linda Moulton Howe, and I had done a series of remote viewings about a craft that had crashed in Brazil and a U.S. program there. So I was able to describe the craft and the occupants and much
more. Was that the recent crash in June, the Maggi UFO?
Yes. Yep.
Yep. I done a bit of a bonus episode on the night after it broke, because Twitter was lighting up around a whole lot of nothing potentially, but then there was just more and more clips coming out, and Arthur Iglesias, who is lives in the UK but a Brazilian native, was translating the Portuguese, I believe it was, and letting us know this is what they're saying, and these people are really panicked and something has happened. And I've done a bit of a summary.
I hadn't heard about it, pardon my ignorance, until she told me about it, today basically, and all I got was a longitude and latitude. And, I just did a very long viewing. And I think that's going to air on her channel tomorrow night.
Okay.
So
from what I had looked at initially then, something potentially crashed near a munitions base where they basically make ammunition. However, there wasn't meant to be any activity really at the time near the base, nothing outside the normal. And after this, there was to have been lights in the sky for a few nights, apparently. And there's a few different videos on there. Some of them are, unfortunately, fakes from previous events or carnivals or drone shows, but they were interspliced with some of the actual footage that people had taken. So wow. This object had crashed, and it looks quite forest, the area, looked quite forestry. And then you can see the smoke coming from the hills. After that, it went kind of quiet, and then there was rumours that there was a lot of US presence there, that the US military had gone in, cleaned things up. And it was very much, it disappeared. Reddit shut it down and it was removed off of Reddit. There was a lot of admins blocking. And I'm not a big Reddit user. Some people might be surprised to know that. But it's something I've just never really got around to getting into. But Reddit started banning a lot of the phrases like Magi UFO, OVNI Magi, which is obviously the Portuguese for UFO. It became a bit of a overnight sensation and then really quickly disappeared. But that's interesting that that there's been more kind of came of it. And is there anything you would say that you could say more on it that you did see?
Absolutely. There is a crash. There are occupants. There is a U.S. program that used to be more international. Now it's more just the United States in South America because there's a long history of essentially like an ET highway that flies over Peru and into the rainforest of Brazil. And it's been going on for a long time. It may even be the cause of the giant animal glyphs in Nazca. But this has been going on for a long time. And there's other, whistleblowers in the military who've spoken about this project and program. So it was a little bit about the project and the program and the crash retrieval and where they took the crash afterwards. They took it to a way station base in Peru. And then from there, they took the biological samples, let's say, beings and the craft. They flew it in one of those giant sea whatever's Hercules. It was refueled in the air and they flew it straight to Wright-Patterson Air Base. And Wright-Patt, there were some leaked documents in budgetary stuff that was very strong evidence that there is a space base, essentially, a space command under Wright-Patt. And they had several levels of biological containment. And the U.S. had just put, I think, $500 million into the improvement of the containment of the labs in there or something. So, that's basically what happened with that. And that the biological stuff stayed there. And that the craft was then, after a couple days, transported to Tonopah, which is another base.
Did you see anything to do with one of these occupants being shot? Because that was one of the rumors at the time. There was a gunshot.
They were all shot, ultimately, right. Yeah.
There was
all
gunshots heard.
Shot.
Yeah, that was one thing that came out from the locals that they heard a round of gunshots after the military had apparently gone to the area and they were certain that these things had been shot. So that's particularly interesting as well, yeah.
And one of the beings apparently survived for a few hours after being shot and was speaking in Portuguese.
Very human, isn't it? Welcome to Earth and Will Smith punches you in the face the US military turn up and shoot you.
What I've said so many times is militaries want to, and men especially, we want to take something and smash it and see how it's made, but will we learn more from a broken watch? Will we learn more from an entire perfect watch, or would we learn more from talking to the watchmakers. You know, I think we've made the very poor decision of trying to just smash the watches and not be smart enough to make the communications with these advanced craft that they've been reaching out to us. There's many, many incidents in UFO history of craft mimicking people, either with, you know, someone will flash a flashlight twice, like Allagash, and it'll flash twice, and then it'll wait for the next advancement of communication, and we don't know what to do, and they're on a mission, and so they get bored, and they're like, oh, this will take too long, pew, and go off to their mission. Even the Nimitz incident, the famous one of late, the craft was physically mimicking the jet fighter, counter-rotating,
yep.
And, you know, there's... it just takes a little bit more patience, I think, and tenacity and brain power to make that communication happen. But I think, you know, we're so desperate for this advanced technology that we're willing to do anything. And even Luis Elizondo said, you know, South America is very hot right now. And Luis Elizondo, who's, you know, the ex-government guy who's now at TTSA, has a speech, I think it was in Spain, where he said, you know, the most important work right now is going on in South America, and I really can't say anymore.
So, and something I will say is I interviewed Anthony Lippe, who's the executive producer of the Unidentified documentary series. Now,
oh, interesting.
This interview with you won't go out for another week or two. My interview with Anthony is allowed to go out. I've got permission from the network tomorrow, which would be the 8th of July. So in preparation for the new series, and Anthony, as people will hear, given this interview is going to be out after the series starts, was very, very good in what he talked about to do with the new series. And he talked at length about Luis Elizondo traveling to South America, and he would not name the countries, but he did say it's a huge part of the series. And he goes there for very, very important talks with some national leaders. And there's a whole area of the show based there. So that's interesting you say that about South America. And I know that's a strong part of the series coming up.
And there is what was a secret program, like I was saying before, that's taking place in South America with basically these teams. That's a special unit. And there's other locations for them across the world. This is their job to get these materials first. And this is a very complex tapestry. A lot of interweaving agencies, groups, organizations, and, you know, information.
So this is a question that I'll have to ask you then, given your ability to see these things. Why do these objects crash?
Well, it seems like many of the crashes have been essentially gifts. And if you look at how many have crashed around the world, they seem to be gifts without a way of scaring us too much. These crashed objects would be there. And you wonder, well, what is the purpose of the gift? Is the gift so we can learn to get off the planet? Is the gift the technology that's on these craft that could help, you know, our environment and our planet and our species? Or is it undeniable physical proof that advanced civilizations exist, which is a very, very powerful piece of evidence? So for Absolutely. Me, I think, you know, go ahead, please.
No, I just want to follow up that I'm all for these things potentially being gifts or, you know, like it's like loot drops if you're a gamer, you know, that you're getting this gift dropped in here. Here's how choose how you use it wisely. But if these things have biological entities on board, are we saying that these things that they're dispensable, that they're potentially clones, and that, you know, if you're going to crash something,
they're,
you can't guarantee they survive.
Beings. Okay. Yes, they're second generation beings that were created for space flight and stuff. But not all of the craft are gifts. They come here to this planet because you would imagine being a really advanced race, the most valuable thing in the universe is not monatomic gold or any element that they could find in greater amounts other places in the universe. The most valuable thing is data, information. Knowledge is power. Information is power. And life forms are one of the densest forms of data there is. It's not just the life form, it's their environment, their interaction with their habitat, their consciousness, their interactions with others of their species, and on and on and on and on. And to me, it's a testament to God's amazing universal biology that advanced civilizations would even need to look at our plant life. They couldn't foresee it. They couldn't foresee this chance and that chance. No, there's so many complex things that have created the unique species that are on this planet that are similar to many others around the universe, but are uniquely precious to Earth. So there's been a very long history of UFOs scanning forests, scanning woods, and going to the rainforest, which is the densest area for life on the diverse life on the planet.
Awesome. No, that's good. That was slightly off the track I was going to go down, but that was really interesting. You brought up Brazil, so some really good conversation there. Thank you. So just to kind of round off the, because I'm going to touch back on some of this stuff. If someone wanted to explore remote viewing or psi abilities, what would you recommend? How do they start? How do they get into it?
It's easy. There's certain videos. There's a great video from Prudence Calabrese. She has like 5 videos. You just watch the first one with a pen and a pad, and she'll walk you through the process. And during that episode, you get to do your very first remote viewing. And then there's the best teacher, I think, now is Dr. Simeon Heim, who has his website is newcrystalmind.com. And I've taken several of his classes, and he's just a great, great teacher. You can go to that newcrystalmind.com site and get a bunch of free information. And of course you can take classes, but I'd be very careful about, you know, what classes you take, when, where, et cetera.
How would you like to see remote viewing or these abilities integrated into society as it stands in 2020?
Well, I think, you know, we teach our kids and our kids have physical education growing up. I think they should have consciousness education. And there's a lot of benefits to it. So much of this ability, all of these abilities, kind of boil down to empathy. And like I was saying with the tuning forks, if you empathize with something, if you connect with it, if you try and resonate with it, information and data starts flowing once you make that connection, like the two tuning forks are reaching the right frequency. So if we taught kids empathy, and that they could learn superpowers, essentially, I think there'd be a lot less school shootings, and we would know how each other feel. We would care how each other feel. I think human potential is so much more than we have allowed ourselves. So I would love to see us explore human potential unbridled, free, unchained, without any sense of shame, without any judgment, or mockery. So people would have the right to, or kids would have the right to fail big. And it helps not just with this stuff, with psychic stuff. If you give them a space to learn and they can fail really big, you may get the best dance ever, or the best architecture ever, or the best music ever. So to me, it ultimately boils down so much to human potential. And I think those abilities should be very calmly and without woo-woo, and, you know, over the top spiritualism, they should be encouraged. Mm-hmm. Because it's one of our senses. You know, everyone's grandma has the sense of intuition, you know, would say, don't do this or this will happen. And you'll be like, oh, right, grandma. And then It happens the next day. And you're like, how did grandma know? You know? Mm-hmm. And we know through many years of, you know, studies that the power of prayer works over distances. We know a lot of these little pieces. We just haven't put it all together yet, but we're close. And I think there's a little bit less shame nowadays to explore this as there was maybe 10, 20 years ago.
Absolutely. So one of your own philosophies, and I take this from your bio and from your videos and, you know, just getting the last couple of weeks, a sense of kind of what you do and what you stand for. There's a lot of talk of, you know, everything's connected, a lot of on love, a lot of oneness and a lot of consciousness. Do you think humanity, where we stand as a species, is anywhere near ready for that next step to have that in its thinking?
You know, as technology grows, it gets more and more dangerous and more powerful. And spiritually, we haven't grown that much as our technology is growing, and our technology is growing faster and faster. And it, in fact, becomes more and more dangerous to, you know, to us, to our race, you know, as obviously demonstrated by nuclear weapons and stuff. And it just, it's essential that we explore this stuff. You know, it's crucial to our future, I believe. And when these advanced races visit us, there's so many stories of them using these abilities, communicating, you know, telepathically, moving objects, knowing, having precognition of what people are going to be doing, reading their minds, all sorts of things like that. So I think, you know, it's once we're able to nail it down as physics and take away the mystery and the spiritual fear and the phenomena aspect of it, it will be so much more useful than the electromagnetic field was and is for us. 200 years after it was discovered, after this guy squashed all the phenomena and unified it into science, it's, you know, we couldn't live without the electromagnetic field now. And I have a feeling that, you know, if we make it 200 years in the future, it will be one of our most used aspects of reality.
I think the way things are going in a minute, if we make it another year into the future, it would be an achievement. So 2020's thrown a lot at us so far.
Yeah, who knows how long we'll survive, but it's not looking good.
So just to start wrapping up then, I want to talk about your, I've got the word work down here, but I noticed you actually changed it yourself to play, that you weren't working on Skinwalker Ranch, it was more play. So your play on Skinwalker Ranch recently was acknowledged by Brandon Fugel. What was that experience like?
Oh, just, I'm still interacting with them and playing with the head scientist, and it's been the most amazing experiences of my entire life and the most broadening of my horizons and increase of my abilities and exploration of these abilities. And it's been for 2 years, you know, it was a real big secret for a long time. And I couldn't talk about, you know, working with the head scientist there. And it has just been a wonderful experience.
How did it come about, you getting involved with Skinwalker Ranch?
It's a long, convoluted story, but I've always had a tendency to try and help people and help groups. And, you know, every day I go for a patrol, I call it, and I try and find a homeless person and help them or someone in need and help them. And there was a scam that was going on. And I'd helped a group of people. And one of the people just happened to be the owner of Skinwalker Ranch. And that friendship grew and grew, and it was just based on friendship and honor and decency and doing the right thing. And I found the integrity of Brandon to be absolutely, you know, incredible. And for such a wealthy, influential gentleman to take the time to, you know, be patient with me and to introduce me to his head scientist and allow me to play and explore, has been absolutely incredible. And some of the most amazing things I've ever experienced in my entire life have been associated with that work.
Anything you can talk about?
Sure. Everything from incredibly strong psychokinetic events to a 2-hour remote viewing with over 20 targets, and they were all stunningly, like unusually stunningly creepily accurate, to working with specialty machines built just for the exploration of these abilities, and much more.
Had you ever remote viewed the ranch previously before you got involved?
No.
Was that just out of no interest, or is it because it had never been approached?
I was doing other things, and, you know, it really hadn't come up, you know, and for me.
For you, now that you've been there and had those experiences, what is the importance of Skinwalker Ranch? You talk about in South America having an ET superhighway going across. What's the importance of Skinwalker Ranch?
Ultimately, I think it's consciousness and the power of consciousness, and that there's real physics going on here. There's a real field going on here. And there is a classic mystery that UFOs demonstrate and also phenomena like Skinwalker demonstrate. I'll just mention three of them. One is that they're precognizant. Both UFOs seem to know where the jet pilot's going to go. With the Nimitz, he knew the next waypoint. At Skinwalker, they know the phenomena knows what you're going to do next and is able to defeat it, and was able to defeat, you know, 20 years worth of the best scientists. Also, it has a tendency, both UFOs and the phenomena, of mimicking you. UFOs will mimic you, mimic your movements and things like that. At Skinwalker, the phenomena will oftentimes present itself as a reflection of your inner psyche, your psychology. If you're militarized, you will have a militarized reaction. There's also the phenomena of, if you see a UFO, oftentimes people talk about it following them home, meaning strange phenomena will follow them home. The same thing with Skinwalker. Many scientists and others have gone there, and then they have strange phenomena happening to them at home. And there's one thing that can explain that. It can follow you home if it's you. You know your future. You are precognizant of yourself. And the role of consciousness and this field and the presence of advanced civilizations all interweave. So, you know, for me, this is science. This isn't woo-woo. And Skinwalker really taught me that we know so little about our consciousness, but it certainly is interwoven with space, time, matter, and energy.
Awesome. We'll move on to listener questions just before we finish off. And I'd just like to say thank you to Mark, one of the listeners, because he was really interested in some of the stuff around Skinwalker Ranch, but that was going to be coming up anyway. So thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, great questions. So first up is Jenna. And Jenna, I'd like to say thank you on the podcast because she was the one who put me in touch with yourself and gave me a heads up as to you're someone who I should be speaking to.
I love you, Jenna.
Yeah, Jenna's awesome. She does great readings as well on Twitter for people free of charge. So get in touch with Jenna. She had a really good question. Jenna said, hearing that you've been working with some interesting groups recently, is there anything about the psi phenomenon you have found surprising?
That I don't know the envelope. I don't know the ends of it. Hutchinson could transmute metals. Ted Owens could cast or call lightning bolts, definitively change the weather. Different psychics have demonstrated, and I don't even like to call them psychics, even psi practitioners have demonstrated incredibly powerful things, amazingly accurate things. I don't know the limit. And I've seen some incredible, mind-boggling stuff.
Great question. Great answer. Thank you, Jenna. Dan has two questions. One is very quick, but the first one would be, why do you think we are here?
I think it might be a transcendence test that our species and life forms are given life. You know, this universe is suspiciously constructed for life. If you look at a chicken farm, you know, you have to have the heat lamp and an area and the chickens can live. And if you look at our universe, the suns are these power plants, energy sources, wonderfully placed, separated from each other by great distances with habitat, planets around them. And it just seems, for so many different reasons, suspiciously constructed for life. So I think our universe was constructed for life. And maybe there's some sort of transcendence possible if we are a good species. You can look at the Fermi paradox and the Fermi wall and our inability to communicate with other civilizations right now as a hint that not many people make that transcendence, not many species make that transcendence. So I hope we do.
Thank you, Dan. And Dan's second question, Dan's a bit of a dog lover. He is asking, how is Miss Sausages?
Oh, Miss Sausages, I could put the camera on her right now, but that... She's 17 years old, and she just soothes my soul, and she's just the most wondrous, wondrous creature. She's really fragile now, too. So, you know, her love and affection really keeps me going, and she has been just the most important thing to me.
I'm a dog person too, so I can relate to that. So we had Grace asked a question. So many journalists and people in general have been arguing on Twitter, particularly the last few days, about the UFO and UAP subject. What would you say to them about their approach currently and the negativity?
That they are not doing quality research. If you deny the existence of UFOs and UAPs, you have just not done the basic research. You're making more conjectures than you've done the actual research. There's research like Victor Vigiani got these documents, indisputable documents from NORAD that talk about intercepted tracks, unidentified tracks, tracks of interest, and the Nimitz incident. The government just released 3 videos of these craft. And it's easy to look at them as a threat, but they haven't used this amazing technology to destroy us or do anything very negative as far as I can determine.
Awesome. I've got one more question. I'm not too sure of the background on this one. Mike asked, is there any more information on the classified documents that were left in your car?
Wow. Well, it's strange that you bring that up, Mike, because something else has come up recently about that. And they've been verified by one of Grant's document guys, and they've been verified by others. And I've gotten into a little trouble over those things. And about 6 months ago, someone tried to slash. I still have a scar here. You can see someone's tried to slash my throat from behind. Never met them before. So the Russian guy with a funny accent. And I kind of wondered if there was a connection between that or what. But the documents still exist and they're being preserved, and some of them are out. Some of them have sneaked out already. Some of the stuff has been given out to people as a dead man's trigger. And so they're there. Some of the information's already come out from those documents. I just haven't been identified as the source.
Awesome. Thank you, Mike. One more question, buddy, before the quickfire round, if you don't mind. UFO Joe on Twitter asked, and let me read you the question.
Oh, this is UFO. This guy doesn't like me.
No.
I know him because I had identified a witness from the Nimitz incident, and he felt I shouldn't have identified that person.
So that's the question. Are you happy answering?
He blocked me. No, you can keep this all in. I think, transparency is really important.
Okay.
And I'd like to speak to UFO Joe. He's blocked me and doesn't like me and talks bad about me or whatever. And, he's welcome to have his opinion. He comes from a different perspective. And, whether I made a mistake in revealing, I won't say the name now, but I have in the past, who the real special witness is from the Nimitz incident that we don't know. The person hasn't come out, hasn't been identified, but people have outed other males that were involved in it. But this person is not male, just to say.
Yeah.
And I feel like even if what I did was a mistake, he should grant me my human frailty and say, well, maybe if he made a mistake, I can forgive him, And, he hasn't even done that. I think he's been very rude by not communicating with me and solving whatever, animosity that he has over that towards me.
So let me ask you the question directly, because you've basically answered it, but do you regret being unethical by outing the female wingman pilot who wanted to remain anonymous and still does?
Well, whether she wanted to remain anonymous is still kind of whatever. I think that the ethicalness of it is a very subjective thing. And I really honestly haven't made my final mind up whether I did the right thing or not. And I really debated about this in my own mind for a long time. But we often talk about people suppressing information and suppressing data. And this is the single most important UFO case in history. It has the most evidence, the most sensory evidence, the most video evidence, the most everything. It's a crucial, crucial case. And I think it almost seems a little sexist to me that he would feel like he has to defend her, more than communicate with me, allow me, if it was a mistake, if I did do the wrong thing, allow me that human frailty to make a mistake, because I'm not perfect. I do, part of my abilities is to find things that are obscured and reveal information. And I'm not going to be another person suppressing information from the public. I just don't think that's right and that's fair. And I also think that this person is part of a incredibly important historic event, and this person should come forward for the benefit of all of us. And this will not hurt her, this person, or their career. This person is a badass. This person is absolutely amazing, has made like over 300 wartime day and night landings on aircraft carriers. This person is a badass. And she's, I won't reveal the name, but she's beautiful. She's incredibly intelligent. And this coming out would not hurt. I don't think it would hurt her career. Many pilots have come out and spoken about these different issues, and everyone else associated with it has come out. And there's been a lot of lies as if Fravor was her, when she's a very important witness and has very important things to say and was the crucial witness. So, you know, what I would say to Joe and to anyone who feels animosity towards me for revealing that information, they may think it's unethical. I'm not even certain myself if I did the right thing or not. And, you know, I can't take back what I did. And I would just ask people like Joe to always communicate with the people they have a problem with, especially within our community. We shouldn't divide ourselves in the UFO research community. Joe's a very serious guy about this research, and so am I. And we care about this topic very much. So we shouldn't divide each other. We should try to find bridges and learning and understanding. You know, if I am wrong, a compassionate, intelligent conversation could have helped me realize that. But other people who are upset at me, Jay, has spoken with me, and we resolved any, you know, a couple people were upset that I had revealed that name. And, you know, just anyone who still has any animosity about that, you know, I apologize that I hurt their feelings. I have a very small viewership, you know, so it's not like I revealed it to the world. And, you know, I ask his forgiveness. No, and I still think it's history and very important stuff.
That's a very honest answer, and I appreciate that. And Joe, again, thank you for the question as well. That would be good if you could get in touch. There's been a lot of animosity on Twitter in the last couple of days, in particular.
Yeah, he's just blocked me and not communicated. And I think within our community, we don't have to worry about disinformation, CIA operatives making us look foolish or like infighters. We do it pretty good ourselves. And I think we should always strive for the highest ideals. And, you know, pragmatism and logic, and also a little bit of compassion too. No one's perfect.
Absolutely not. You're right. Thank you for the questions, folks. There was a few other ones sent in, but just due to time constraints and also the body of the interview, we've answered quite a lot of those as well. Just to finish off on the quick fire round, it's a few words or sentences on various projects and topics, and then we'll kind of finish off. So the first one would be the Montauk project.
BS.
I thought you might say that. The next one would be, and this one's kind of for me, the Men Who Stare at Goats, the movie. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Have you read the book?
No, I haven't.
Do you know what it's about?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Is it something you're going to see, or do you just choose not to?
I choose not to.
Okay.
But I believe in the abilities. I know they exist.
I just wondered, given the tone of the film, if you would avoid it, given it is more comical and obviously kind of fantasized, given the nature of the thing. It doesn't have to be, does it? So the next one would be the friendly and hostile ET narrative.
I only believe in the friendly ET narrative. I'm not a subscriber to the hostile ET narrative, and I've never seen any convincing evidence. There's plenty of stories about hostile negative experiences, negative abductions, but I'm highly suspect of those.
Dr. Stephen Greer.
That's a very complex subject. He is someone that the UFO community should always be incredibly grateful for so many different things. The press club event where he brought out all these people for all of his interviews. But there's also a lot of fear-mongering with, you know, a giant fake UFO event, and the government's going to be doing this and that.
Cool. CE5?
Very real, very important. the technique is everything.
Tom DeLong?
Fear-monger.
And the last one I'd like to finish off with all the guests. What does disclosure mean to you?
Revealing the reality that advanced civilizations have been visiting our planet.
Excellent. That's great. Listen, buddy, it's been amazing talking with you. If you want to just let the listeners know how they can get in touch with you, how they can subscribe to your YouTube channel.
They could just go to Alien Protocols on YouTube or to email me if anyone wants healing. We never charge for any of this stuff. If there's someone sick who needs healing, if you need a remote viewing, if you want tips on psi abilities, it would be a pleasure to help in any way we can. You could just email at alienprotocols@gmail.com.
That's great, buddy. It's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. God bless you and the listeners. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the show this week. Really cool chat with Buddy from Alien Protocols. Remember, Calvin Parker and Brian Arnold will be up next on the show, and I am in talks with some more people to come on the show that I just, again, unfortunately can't name quite yet. But again, all your support is appreciated. Follow the show on Twitter at UFOUAPAM. Follow on Facebook, That UFO Podcast, and also over on Instagram, That UFO Podcast. Keep in touch, folks. Again, patreon.com/thatufopodcast if you want to pledge and support the show, and you get some bonus goodies and content for that as well. Again, been great talking to everyone the last couple of weeks online, folks. Thank you so much. All your support and listens are really what are keeping this show as popular as it is, and it really has been amazing these first couple of months. So plenty more to come from myself. Again, keep looking up, folks. You never know what you might see.
Designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right outside of my window, and when I shoved out the screen, he made it an issue. I don't think he expected me to see his ass, but I'd had some champagne and smoked a little rain. Meditated game of state full on meta. Can't imagine how it could have been any better. I got to the top of the stairs and there he was. Like, you awake? I was about to abduct you, cuz. I jumped back and nearly kissed myself. Then I climbed out the window after the elf. And I woke up in my bed and there was something on my head. And everything was weird and everything was red. And I called up my boys. They thought this was noise. They thought it was a dream. They thought it was my toys. They thought it was my problems. And they think I should seek therapy. And I don't know what to do because it doesn't really scare me. Consider your life.
One of the largest Star Wars fan collections in the world is coming to Kosai. Unofficial Galaxies opens on May 10th, and this is a one-of-a-kind exhibition with iconic characters, props, legendary ships, costumes, and behind-the-scenes secrets. It's going to be a must-see whether you're a hardcore Star Wars fan or just curious about one of the most famous sci-fi franchises of all time. Unofficial Galaxies is coming to Kosai starting on May 10th, so get your tickets now at Kosai.org.